Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Matt Golston is with us. He's a terrific engineer who's had a couple other interesting careers as well, bringing all that knowledge together in broadcast engineering at the local and regional level. Matt Golston is coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, not in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville today. I'm visiting dear old dad down in Georgia today, and so I'm coming to you from my dad's office here in Barnesville, Georgia. Glad to be here, and I'm glad you've joined us. We're going to have a great show today. We're going to kind of have a well-rounded show about broadcast engineering. We're going to find out a lot about the tips and tricks and things you need to know to be a good all-around engineer at your broadcast facility. And most of us are, you know, as a full-time engineer, sometimes we're called upon to fix the toilets, fix the plumbing, fix an electrical outlet, get somebody's keys out of their car from being locked in, just, you know, all those things, and broadcast engineering as well, making the station sound great, be reliable, and be legal too. So that's all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. In fact, let's go ahead and just introduce to you our guest before we make our announcement from Nautel. And our guest is Matt Golston from Lafayette, Louisiana. Matt, welcome into the show. It's great to see you.
Pleased to be here.
Pleased that you're here. You're the chief engineer at the Town Square stations, right?
Town Square Media in Lafayette.
Lafayette, Louisiana. So, and
yes, sir.
We're not going to reminisce too much, but when I was a tyke, when I was a kid, like 4, 5, 6 years old, I lived in Lafayette, Louisiana. So I've been there. I mentioned to you Brentwood Boulevard. You know Brentwood Boulevard?
I think so. But again, I'm actually not originally from here either. So there's still a lot of the city that I don't know.
Sure. And Brentwood, it's one of those boulevards that's like barely a boulevard. It's got a little strip of grass down the middle, about 3 feet wide. That's it. Right. And I went to Woodvale Elementary School in Lafayette. But that was 53 years ago. I wonder if it's still there.
Yep. A lot has changed. A lot has changed.
I'm sure. Do they still have drive-through daiquiri stands?
Yes. Yes, sir. They still
You can drive in your car and get an alcoholic daiquiri. Yeah.
So for the people that don't know, the way it works here, it's not an open container if you haven't put the straw in it. They put a little paper sticker, like one of those little dot stickers, over the top of the straw hole. If you haven't broken that sticker, it's not an open container.
Is that so that the officer can tell whether or not you've broken the container open?
Yes, but you could have lifted the lid and took a sip, but I mean, you know, it's kind of on your honor.
Yeah. Louisiana is a different place. It's one of the places where we don't have a British common law. We have Napoleonic Code. Being a lawyer in Louisiana is a different affair than the other 49 states, I would imagine.
I mean, you're talking to a Mississippi boy that grew up in a dry county, so I'm in a totally different environment.
Oh, so Matt Golston, but you can tell just by our opening talk here, it's going to be a fun show. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the Telos Alliance, so if you hear me say some nice things about my employer, well, it's just because I know all about their equipment, their technologies and stuff. And again, today I'm not in my usual Telos Alliance studio, but I am in Georgia. Glad to be at Dad's office. All right. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Nautel. And you know, and I know, but I'm going to remind you about the Nautel webinar series. It's really a roundtable discussion. In fact, it's called Transmission Talk Tuesdays. Transmission Talk Tuesdays. We'll get to that in just a second. But I want to tell you about a promotion that Nautel still has going on. It's going on through the end of October. But at the end of October, it's over with. And that is the GV series. You buy a GV series transmitter. These are the bigger transmitters. And this is a great time to replace your old clunky tube-type transmitter or maybe an early model solid-state transmitter that's not so reliable anymore. get you a Nautel GV series FM transmitter. When you get one now, you can get a second exciter built into it. You get that for free. Normally, that is a big extra cost option to get a second exciter, as a backup exciter. This will let you stay on the air if the first exciter fails, which rarely do. But if you need to make some other adjustments to the exciter, you can pop over to the backup exciter and use that. There is a form. You see it on the screen right there if you're watching. If you go to nautel.com/11things, that's 11things, we'll have the link in the show notes. You can just sign yourself right up there. Or, hey, just talk to your Nautel rep. If you don't know who your Nautel rep is, get in touch with Nautel and bother them. But probably your Nautel rep has been bothering you, especially if it's Jeff Welton in the middle of the U.S. But Nautel has reps all over the U.S., Canada, and all over the world, as a matter of fact. So check with your Nautel rep and get your price on a GV series transmitter and get this special promotion on a free second exciter for backup. It's a great deal, and one that won't be repeated. October 31st, it's all over with. Now, about the Transmission Talk Tuesdays, go to nautel.com/webinars and click on the Transmission Talk Tuesdays. Sign yourself up. You know, even if at the last minute you can't go, you might as well sign up. Get the reminder. They'll send you just about 2 email reminders. You can easily add it to your Outlook calendar or your Google calendar. There's a little drop-down thing. Click on that. They go right into your calendar, and you can be reminded of the Transmission Talk Tuesday webinar. In fact, I think our guest, Matt Golston, Matt, you've been a guest on the webinar, haven't you, with Jeff Welton?
Jeff and I did one on HVAC installs and maintenance.
Good deal.
A couple months ago.
Yeah, and I was on earlier this month talking about MPX over IP and also MPX over AES Digital. So it's a great series. It's also a roundtable, so you as a audience member are invited to ask questions. In fact, Jeff can even turn your mic on, let you speak, and ask questions of Jeff and or his guests. So check those out. They're always great information to have. I try to catch every single one of them. I did catch the one that I was in. All right. We're talking to Matt Golston. Matt, you're in Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm sure it's, as I remember in my childhood, hot, humid, sometimes very rainy. I'm sure you have some challenges there. And in our talk today, we're going to talk about, I promoted this on social media by saying, if you're a broadcast engineer and you just want tips on darn near everything, Matt is a very well-rounded engineer in terms of just everything that he knows. He knows how to take care of transmitter studios. You were a consultant for quite a while in your career, and so you had to know something about everything. In fact, you kind of had to be good at it, or else people wouldn't hire you. There's so many places we could start at, Matt, but why don't you just hit a couple of the high points of your career, and I guess if I'm asking, why are you qualified to talk to us about what a chief engineer should pay attention to?
Well, I've been doing this for a little over 20 years for a lot of different people in a lot of different places, from South Tennessee all the way to almost the Texas state line, because I work over in Lake Charles some for Town Square. Mm-hmm. Probably I've done a little work for Clear Channel, for Cumulus, for Town Square Media, and a lot of independent broadcasters. So, and worked on transmitters as old as like a 20V3. All the way up to brand new Nautels and Gates Airs. So, I mean, you have to be really agnostic to be a good engineer. As far as transmitters and equipment, you really don't get to choose what your employer buys in most cases. Sometimes you do, if you're in the right position. But
you know, that's a good point. And one of the, in our pre-show meeting, one of the last points we talked about, let's go ahead and make it first now, about broadcasters and what they should be budgeting or spending for equipment. You made some examples of audio processors, but I'm sure you can make examples of exciters, audio consoles, and other things that a station needs, or maybe even automation systems. Do you buy what you think is the best? Do you buy the best you can afford? Do you go cheap? Do you buy less than you can really afford? Talk to me about your philosophy on budgeting for broadcast equipment to sound better and be reliable.
Well, the first thing I look at, if I was looking from the perspective of an owner, would be you have a budget and it's probably a hard number. And then so you have to look at, if I'm operating a station now, we're going to assume it's not a brand new station because there's not that many brand new stations that are happening. Sorry. Dell command update. There are not that many brand new stations that are being built these days. But if you have an operating station and you want to improve it, You have to look for where your best dollars are going to be spent. And I think you and I talked about this. The best place to put your best dollars is in investing in the input source material. And then once you have a pristine library of input source material, no matter where you get that from, whether you get it from the label, whether you purchase a library, no matter what you do, once you know you have the highest quality source material you possibly can, then you actually have something to feed an expensive audio processor or an expensive, you know, have expensive equipment to put it into. But it doesn't matter how much money you put into other equipment. You feed garbage into it, you get garbage out of it. So the next thing that I would start focusing on after you have pristine source material is doing everything you can to start reducing the noise floor. So start looking for sources where you have equipment that's got aging capacitors and aging op amps and different things that are raising the noise floor. And it's nothing wrong with analog equipment per se, but if you can start eliminating it and start converting over to audio over IP, there are so many advantages to audio over IP, not only in reducing the noise floor, reducing cable clutter, giving you expandability and the ability to be able to start routing things and be able to make changes from home over a computer, you know, by a VPN, that there's just no way that I would build a non-audio over IP environment today. It just wouldn't be a good investment unless it's an extremely small installation. You know, if it was a one studio, one off environment, I could see that. But if it's anything like what I'm operating in here, a 6 or 7 station cluster, that's a poor investment. Because it's so complex and so much wire to run, and you should really be running. And even if you're doing an analog situation, you should be doing it over Cat 6 so that you can, with something like Studio Hub converters, so that you can convert to audio over IP easily. Because just like they talk about streaming is the way that things are going, audio over IP is the future. There's no doubt about it. So don't deny that that's the way things are going. You will eventually go that way.
And, you know, even though I work for a company that does audio over IP, in fact, some would say that that Axia, a division of Telos, invented audio over IP at least for broadcast, starting back in 1999, actually. And so, yes, I have I eat my own dog food, so to speak, at my 18 right. radio stations. We use audio over IP, but I've been given the choice by my business partner. Hey, I can buy this older console that's analog, or we can I can buy it used, or we can buy either a used or maybe a new AOIP console. Dude, if you buy that analog console, I'm gonna be on my back underneath that thing for 3, 4, 5 days. I'll be stripping wires, I'll be soldering, I'll be crimping stuff. In the end, you will never have a noise floor, you know, that's down as low as we could get otherwise. And by the way, if you want to move it to another building, another room, another anything, all that's got to come back apart. Punch blocks, barrier strips, whatever that you use. With AOIP, I mean, it's literally some Cat 5 cables. Yes, you've got your inputs and outputs, but as you mentioned, that can be done with Studio Hub. You can either wire your own or you can buy adapter cables, and you can build a whole studio with maybe never lighting up your soldering iron. In fact, lately, the only reason I've had to light up the soldering iron is because I didn't buy enough Studio Hub. And if there is an audio problem, it's never a buzz or a hum or a level imbalance. If there's an audio problem, it's usually because Windows did an update that I got to go fix the numbering of my sound cards. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but man, no. I would not go back to analog no. after AOIP.
I mean, I know I'm not the only consulting engineer or even chief engineer that's tried to give advice to other station owners in this way, just to do a cost benefits analysis and show them at best buying a quality analog console from a major manufacturer versus buying an audio over IP console, even if the analog is cheaper by the time you pay all the labor for the consultants to come in and do all of the installation. Break even is the best case scenario. Maybe you might be investing 10 or 15% more to go audio over IP now, but it's so worth it. You just don't understand, because every time you're making a change, you're paying extra labor from now on out. Whereas for me to add a satellite receiver or do something or change some GPIO, it's just click, 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 click. Whereas before, with 12 satellite receivers that you see back there, if I wanted to add a satellite show or something, it was all being done on punch blocks and soldering pins. And now all those pins are virtual, in a virtual environment, and you're going into something like Pathfinder or Navigator and changing that with a mouse, and it's no sweat. So, you know, it's literally something I could do from home in my pajamas.
If a broadcast engineer hasn't yet installed any audio over IP, do you have any recommendations for how to get started with that? What if you're a little bit intimidated by, you know, a slew of IP addresses and channel numbers, that kind of thing? What should an engineer do?
The number one thing I think we talked about in the pre-show, I'm very brand agnostic. I believe that any major audio over IP manufacturer is investing enough in product development that all of the major manufacturers out there are making a quality product that works. You should go with the product that your trusted consultant knows how to do the best. So if you have a consultant you've been working with for 10 years and they're very comfortable with Axia, you should consider that strongly and not ask them to learn another product that you don't already have an investment in. That's my philosophy. I'm not saying that you shouldn't consider other products if they have something that they do well that that you want to do. But if you have a consultant that really speaks the Axia language or the Wheatstone language or the SAS language, and they know that, you want to maintain that relationship with that consultant, you should strongly consider doing what they already know how to do. It's not that they're trying to sell you something just to make money. They're trying to sell you something they're comfortable with. And I believe in that. I don't believe any of the four or five people that are really making audio over IP stuff. I believe they all build a quality product.
Up until 4 or 5 years ago, you know, before we had AES-67, if you bought Axia, if you bought Wheatstone, or if you bought Ravenna, something running on those standards, they were not play nice with other things. Now, okay, right. Axia and Ravenna got together and said, yeah, we'll talk to you if you'll talk to us. Okay, great. But there was no language for getting them together. And now, at least with my employer, and I'm involved with a lot of pre-sales conversations with TV stations, radio stations, it turns out that AES-67 is playing a big role in getting whatever your choice of AOIP system is, whether it's WheatNet or Axia or something that is talking Ravenna. They need to talk to maybe a CalRec audio console, the TV station, and we'll do that with AES-67. I got to say, AES-67 is still not as convenient as I know something like LiveWire is, just because we have, you know, drop down boxes and click, 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 and it can be done. But AES-67 gets you to a point where you're not locked in to only the equipment built by a certain manufacturer. It gives you choices. Hey, I want some Genelec speakers with my Axia system. Guess what? The Genelec speakers can speak AES-67, and so they can just be right on the network with everything else.
And because AES-67 doesn't support everything moving back and forth, it's primarily an audio standard, you're going to probably want to have some environments where you're going to want to have both some blades and some nodes, and use that to transfer GPIO and audio to each other, and therefore be able to move everything. And that's very common, and especially in larger, more complex environments, have two or three blades and two or three nodes and link them together and be able to move information back and forth between a Pathfinder environment and a Navigator environment. And there's nothing wrong with that. And again, like I said, I have a brother that works in the professional sound world, and everything they do is Dante. And that's huge in the pro sound touring environment. So to have a system that speaks Dante can give you a lot of advantages if you have to interface with live sound equipment, like a Midas console or something like that. So there's advantages to every system. Yeah.
Hey, one thing we're going to talk about after a quick commercial break, Matt. By the way, we're talking to Matt Golston. He's the chief engineer for the Town Square Media Stations in Lafayette, Louisiana. Matt has a great experience in consulting and building AM and FM transmitter sites and studios, maintaining those now. And by the way, we have the first time we're going to promote it. Today's tip of the week is worth hanging on for. I was amazed at a couple of things that I got a preview of. So you're going to want to hang on for the tip of the week at the end of the show. Yes, if you're watching a playback of this, you could fast forward to the end, but don't. We're gonna have the rest of the hour is going to be great. But coming up, Matt, I want to at least talk a little bit about cameras in the studios. And right now we're going to hear from Broadcast Bionics and their product, Camera One. Be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics, designed to bring video to your audio content, visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
Incredibly well thought out and works great. Check it out from Broadcast Bionics at bionic.radio. Bionic.radio is the website, and you can read all about Camera One and the other really cool content creation and management products from Broadcast Bionics. Good folks, and they understand broadcasting really well. Matt Golston, the chief engineer at Town Square Media in Lafayette, Louisiana, is our guest. He's been a consultant, done a lot of things in radio in 20 years, and he's been in some allied fields as well, which has allowed him to bring knowledge from other fields into broadcasting. Matt, talk to me for at least a minute or two about cameras and where you see cameras in the studio going. How are folks using those now?
So we don't have that installed here yet. We haven't gone there, although we did have a video department where we were doing outside video, but we haven't done cameras in the studios really. But I do have some other friends that are chief engineers at other stations, one in Baton Rouge and specifically, where they have cameras in every studio, two or three different cameras, and actually are using that specific switcher that was featured in the commercial, that little Blackmagic Designs switcher. And everything they do for the whole airshift is live streamed on, I'm not sure what platform, but on a live stream that people can watch, probably through an app. So that is definitely another thing that is coming, especially to top 100 markets. If it's not already in your studio, it's something that's in demand and it will be coming, I have no doubt.
Yeah, years ago, we did this in a very manual way in our station in American Samoa, and we were on the cable system there, and we're just actually under this coronavirus lockdown in Samoa, but when we get off of lockdown, I think we're getting a Camera One system there to do automatic switching. So I think it's just another way to reach people and let people listen to the radio, maybe on their cable channel or maybe streaming, and they can watch what's going on in the studio and see what these radio celebs actually look like. So that means we got to brush our teeth and comb our hair and so forth.
We do a lot of streaming. We do a lot of interpersonal communication with through our apps, through chats, through push notifications, things like that. We just haven't made that jump to the cameras in the control room yet. But I have a feeling, just like a lot of things we've been talking about, that's only a foregone conclusion that it's going to come down the road, because everything that we're doing as a media is progressing towards the digital, towards the mobile device, and away from in car. I mean, it's, people still want to listen in the car, but if you can't touch them in other places, you're going to become more and more irrelevant. So
I know you've built a number of studios. Let's talk a bit about your philosophy about building radio studios. And by the way, since we don't know when COVID's, when we're going to be all back in studios all the time, if we're going to be in and out of studios. So we're going to also talk about working from home and how you like to handle that. But let's talk about studio construction. You've built a lot. What are some of your overriding philosophies on building studios?
Well, especially like we've redone four studios in this building that we're sitting, that I'm sitting in right now. One of the big things I have when I build a studio is no wires, nothing can hang down. I tell the janitor when he's here, if you can't run the vacuum under the table and not worry about catching a wire or knocking something off the air, you let me know. I'll make it where you can, because the place has got to stay clean. So I know I can't get you in there right now, but if you shined a camera or a light up under there, nothing is hanging down. And it didn't used to be that way with when it was an audio over IP, but it has to be that way. And leave yourself plenty of rack space. You'll never be able to anticipate what you're going to add in the future. So don't hem yourself into one rack, or, and also leave plenty of blank spaces. These nodes and blades generate heat. And just because it's only a one RU device, we have found that if you don't leave a space above and below a blade or a node, you'll find that the temperatures in that unit are going to run hotter than you might like, and the components in there are not going to last like they would if you would have left a space and some, and put some vented rack panels in there. So, just like anything else, you don't want to cook them. Same thing. We used to have some racks that would have like five mic processors all rammed together with no spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like a mic processor, especially if it's got Class A components in it, they get hot and they put off a lot of heat. And if you stack them up like that, well, the ones above the bottom one, they cook. So, you know, you're rebuilding them all the time. So you just have to take a lot of things into consideration. You have to calculate your heat loads, your electrical loads. You have to look at power redundancy. I'm really fond of some of these products, like, for example, some of the Tyline products that have dual power inputs, and a lot of other products are some of the Wheatstone products are moving that way. I'm not familiar with every product that's that way, but the more and more products that have dual power supplies or have an external unit that has dual power supplies that can plug into that unit, like Cisco switches do, that gives you so much redundancy. In most of my racks, I run dual UPSs that are monitored by SNMP, and it gives us that level of redundancy where we know even if we lose a UPS, we're not going to lose that control room. We're not going to lose that that rack. And then, for example, if I do lose a control room, you can set up automatic silent sensing in the audio over IP domain. I'm sure you can do this in Axia as well, to automatically fail over to a blade or a node in the server room and route around that without even having human intervention, something you could never do with an analog console. I mean, I guess you could if you had a complicated system of relays or something, but yeah, it wouldn't be simple. It would not be simple.
But it's just that it can be a complicated system of relays. And that actually brings up a point. For decades and maybe almost 100 years, we engineers, those who preceded us, built studios that were, I call it console-centric. It was all about the console, everything wired to the console, and the output of the console is what fed the air chain. And even when the station, if the station was unattended for a while, you had to leave the faders up on the console. That's changed. With AOIP, you're not console-centric, you are now network-centric. How has that changed life for you?
Well, one of the things that we did, there are some audio over IP environments where they use commodity switches, especially some of the Dante environments. We don't. We use enterprise level switches, primarily from Cisco, because you can get them with dual power supplies. You can get a DC connection for them where you can run them off a battery. And that offers a lot of redundancy. I mean, we have a generator on the plant, but say that generator doesn't crank. Say you have a transfer switch malfunction. The larger and larger the market becomes, the more you need to start looking at redundancy, because the more a spot's worth and the more you lose when you have lost airtime. You just have to start looking when you start configuring your racks. If this rack goes offline, how much am I going to lose? Like, how am I going to route around this? Planning is key. Like, I sit down and I CAD everything up and I look at how am I going to, route all my power? How am I going to route my network? What's my catastrophic plan? Like, if this satellite rack goes down back here, how do I have everything plugged in? I know all these satellite receivers are in one rack, but there's actually two power strips back there. They're routed to two dedicated circuits that go into the other room that are in a panel that's dedicated, and they're on two separate UPSs. So there is a level of redundancy there. But you just have to think through those things and try to avoid a single point of failure. And there's redundant receivers there for Westwood One, for Premier, for ESPN. So if I lose one of those circuits, I'm only going to lose either receiver A or receiver B. So it's a whole thought process about figuring out how to get rid of single points of failure.
You mentioned two UPSs in a rack, maybe every rack. I don't know what you got, but talk to me about your philosophy on UPSs. I must say I haven't had the best luck with UPSs, and maybe some of it's my fault, but it seems like I've had a number of UPS failures and UPSs that don't last as long as I wish they would. What's your philosophy, and how do you go about getting good UPS behavior and longevity?
So develop a relationship with a good battery supplier in your area. I've had really good luck with Interstate Battery, but there's Batteries Plus, there's other people. Make sure, the reason I started going with Interstate Battery, he guarantees me that no battery stays on the shelf in his warehouse for more than 6 months. And so that's what you really got to watch out for, is getting old batteries. Same thing, make sure you buy the high drain batteries when you put them back in there. I never buy the battery packs off Amazon and stuff. I get my batteries local. Test your UPSs every week. I run mine generator on a load. So every time the generator cranks, these UPSs get a test. And also, don't let your UPSs go 6 years without changing the batteries. Put them on a regular schedule. Get a Dymo labeler and put a label on the front of the UPS saying when you change the cells. And 2 or 3 years, if it's a critical UPS and not just under somebody's desk, change the batteries. I know there's an expense there. Budget for it. If I have a spreadsheet and it has all my UPSs in it, and when the batteries were changed, and I actually just put them in my Outlook calendar and it pops up and says, hey, STL rack number 2, time to change the batteries in the UPS. I just get a reminder on my phone and I just go to the store and buy some batteries, because we can budget for that. So that's the key.
Do you have a brand or a technology, online versus offline? Do you have a style of UPS that you tend to prefer?
We buy only full double conversion online UPSs, nothing but. Mm-hmm. No line interactive UPSs, full double conversion. They cost more, but this is the only technology that's truly protecting your equipment, because it's taking the line in, running an inverter, the inverter's charging the battery is running the equipment. So that's the only way that you really want to go. Otherwise, you're really investing your money into false security.
And what do you think about the UPSs that are big enough to run the whole department? So I've seen some big Liebert, for example, a brand. I'm sure there are others that are big like that.
So I've worked in a couple of facilities for when I worked for some other companies that had those. Pluses and minuses to that. Huge plus, when you have a power outage, you know, every circuit in your building is covered. Huge minus. If you have a problem with it, everything is at risk. Other huge minus that nobody ever thinks about when they buy it. When it comes time to change batteries, you're breaking off $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 to change these batteries, and you're probably paying a technician from Liebert or somebody like that to come in and change those batteries, because that's not really something you want one of your people doing. It can be very dangerous. It's a big deal. I just actually, during Hurricane Laura, ran into a situation with a TV station that we share a site with. They had a UPS out there that's big enough to run their TV transmitter. So it's a big UPS. Mm. And it was actually backfeeding the 480 power line. And because the switch, the transfer switch did something dumb and actually causing linemen to be in danger. And we couldn't figure out what was going on because the line company turned the power back on. And the power was way higher voltage than what it should have been. And that's because power was coming out of the UPS and being added to the power company's voltage. And so that UPS had to be taken out of circuit, like it had to be bypassed. So you have to be really careful, because you've got a source there that can become a source with the transfer switch. It can become a source that you didn't anticipate. So, but I'm not saying those systems aren't good. We just have chosen here to go with a distributed system rather than the large. We have clusters in our company that have those large UPSs, just not here. And we did discuss it, but we went the other way.
Yeah, I've seen people go both ways, and I would agree. There's got to be pluses and minuses there. We're talking to Matt Golston. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I said the biggest minus is that huge punch in the stomach when you got to peel off $10,000 to put the batteries back in it. No general manager likes doing that.
What if the general manager trades out Teslas for the sales staff? And if the power goes out, somebody from the sales staff's got to bring their Tesla over real quick and hook its battery up to your UPS to keep it going, and then they would rotate the test. Never mind. That's probably not a good idea.
I'll tell you a funny story. The best thing we had was when the electric cars first came out, we had an advertiser that had a Nissan Volt. And every time he would come to meet with us about buying advertisement or whatever, he'd bring his car and plug it in the outlet on the back side of the building and charge it while he was here. It's like,
he figures he's spending money with you. He's going to get a little back.
Take a little electricity, yeah. So.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Hey, we're talking to Matt Golston. He's the chief engineer for the Town Square Media stations in Lafayette, Louisiana. We're learning about a number of little of areas. Matt has been a consultant for years, and now he's only engineering for less than a dozen stations at a time instead of 100 stations at a time. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcaster General Store. You can find all kinds of things, everything you need, at Broadcaster's General Store at bgs.cc, including the Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4. Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Matt Golston about how he likes to handle remote broadcasting, including broadcasting from home. But the Pro Mix 4 is a great way to handle this. Now, look at this. The Pro Mix 4 is actually a mono audio console. That seems a little weird, doesn't it? But you know what? If it's just your voice going through it, if it's a sports broadcast, if it's voice tracking from home or a live operation from home or a remote from a car dealer or a parade, mono is what you need. And it simplifies things greatly. You can actually send your talent out on remote with a Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4 and set it up themselves. Easy to do. The connectors on the back are those famous connectors that handle both quarter-inch tip ring sleeve and XLR connectors. So they can handle both mic level and line level inputs. There's a picture of it right there on your screen, the Pro Mix 4. Some of the features here, it's a full-featured audio mixing console good for any broadcast studio, but also excelling in remote broadcasts and podcasting applications as well. It's got three mic inputs and or line inputs. They can be either one, as well as a dedicated line input that can also be switched between a balanced line input, and you can use the internal USB connection with your laptop. So you can get audio out of your laptop and mix it in with the program. Other features include a program limiter, a balanced and unbalanced mix bus, and a mix minus output, while offering three independent headphone amps. That's, yes, independent headphone amps with IFB program pan controls and a comprehensive studio monitoring system. So just a great array of features built in, and they're all easy to use. They're just clear as can be. If you want an even more professional setup, like for sports broadcasting, where everybody gets their own on-off switch, a cough switch, a headphone volume control, you can drive multiple of their AHR1 Plus headphone amplifier systems. So this is the known as the ProMix 4 from Broadcast Tools. Look how easy it is to use. An on-off button and a volume control for each fader. I mean, anybody can use this. Plus the headphone controls and the USB control for the USB input. It's really easy, but that built-in program limiter can really help too. When the sports announcer yells out something like, "He shoots, he scores," you can keep that from distorting with the built-in program limiter. It's a great box. Great box. For Broadcast Tools, if you know Don Wingate and Broadcast Tools, you know they make stuff that just works. So check it out. The best way to get one is to contact Broadcasters General Store, bgs.cc. Their phone number is 352-622-7700. Yes, I'm saying that from memory. I'm not reading it off the screen because I call them a lot. Always have during my broadcasting career. Broadcasters General Store, they've just got everything, and really sharp pencils too. So check them out. bgs.cc or 352-622-7700. Put that in your Rolodex and contact my friends at Broadcasters General Store. All right, we are talking to Matt Golston, chief engineer at Town Square Media in Lafayette, Louisiana. Matt, tell me about the stations you've got there. How many AM, how many FM, what you got under your hood?
Here in Lafayette, we have 5 FMs and 2 AMs. Okay. One DA and 1 Omni AM, and then 5 FMs. So it's a pretty busy little cluster for a little town this size. Mm-hmm. But and then we,
You've got I used to live there, but that was 53 years ago when I lived there. There was a university there at the time. It was Southwestern College. Maybe it's a university now. Is it?
It's the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Yeah.
There you go. So all right.
Yep.
Do you do any sports broadcasts with them?
We are the flagship station for them, and they're Division I Sun Belt Conference. And mm-hmm. So we handle all of their broadcasting for every sport they do. And they're now affiliated with Learfield IMG College. That wasn't the case when I came here. We used to handle everything locally, but that's something they've signed a deal in the last couple of years. But we still mm-hmm. handle all the broadcasting, even through Learfield. So
tell me how you guys have been dealing with COVID and the lockdown restrictions and so forth. How have you been setting up people to work from home, for example?
So we have some people that were broadcasting from home. We are now completely back in the studio, but we have a product. Now we're an RCS plant when it comes to automation, and they have a product called Zeta2Go, which is very convenient. And you simply can, all you need is a laptop and a headset, even Apple earbuds would work, and Chrome, and just use, it's just a secure website that you go to. And once you log in, you get a web version of the automation system. You can voice track. You can even go live using streaming audio. I mean, obviously, it's got some compression to it, but you can go live right there from the interface. And that solves a lot of problems. Now, we do use like the Tyline Merlin with Reportit. We have that for every station, so we use that as to do remote breaks. We also use... obviously, like Adobe Audition to edit audio and then FTP that up for things like spots and stuff. But we've been very lucky to have enough of a large enough building to be able to have physical social distancing and be able to keep people in here, I would say 90% of the time, and not now the sales staff's been at home. But as far as our programming and sales departments are on opposite sides of the building from each other with a lobby in between. So we've been able to basically just say the programming department's going to come in for their air shift and then go home and not mingle around and just keep that social distance and just stay in your control room and mind your own business. And that's work. And do a lot of hand washing and just kind of do what you need to do. So, and that's worked. Yeah.
So one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about, and our friendship on Facebook, and I've seen you deal with tower crews. I wanted to get into the notion of working with tower crews, picking the right tower crew, knowing what they're capable of, knowing what they need, maybe some micromanagement in. I've experienced some tower crews that needed a micromanagement in some things, and others that just seemed to know what they were doing. Then they got it done. I had to tell them, so, you know, don't unplug this coax. You know, the antenna you want is on this coax. Talk to me about your relationship with tower crews to get the best success you can out of tower work that you have to have done.
The number one thing that I always have that I've learned from when I was brand new and knew nothing is that you have to value a tower crew. Like once you find a good tower crew, never let go of them, because just like an engineer, they're really hard to find. They're a very rare and valuable commodity, and just like an engineer, they require some teaching and mentoring and training in how to be like you want them to be. And so develop a relationship with their foreman or supervisor, whatever you want to call them. I don't get in the weeds with all of the individual climbers. I develop a relationship with the supervisor, and I explain to him what I want or her what I want, and sort of tutor and train them along the way if they're new to me, and let them relay that to their people because they understand how to communicate with their people. So I just try to communicate with them, and that seems to work well for me. Now, don't get me wrong. If I see a person on my job site doing something that's not safe, I'm going to say something right now. But beyond that, I'm going to let them run their crew. And I'm just going to tell them, this is what I need you to do. I'm going to be a part of their safety meeting. I'm going to go over the job. And then I'm just going to sit back and let them handle it. And but one of the things I always tell the tower crew that I expect them to do is, I need pictures of everything that you do up on the tower, because I can't be up there. I need you to bring the parts down that you find that were broken, not because I don't trust you, but I just need to understand what's going on. I need to feel like that my eyes were able to see. And in the day and age that everybody's got a camera phone, there's no excuse for me not to get pictures. Also, if you climb by something that's broken, take a picture. Let me know, or call me right then and say, hey, I see a big place of insulation on this 4-inch line that's torn off. You know, what do we want to do about this? And I'll say, take a picture and text me. You know, it's one of these things, you know, like just be proactive. Don't just tell me, well, I was only up here to change this light, so I ignored the fact that we had 4 broken hangers. You know, it's my option as the person paying the bill to determine what gets done, or my option to call my employer and determine what gets done, not your option to not tell me. So, you know, it's just let me know while you're on the tower if you find something, because quite often they'll find something, especially when you're going through 2 or 3 hurricanes a year. They're going to find something. So just, and also I think we talked in the pre-show about going up prepared. Don't go up without taking all the necessary tools and items to be able to fix common problems, because otherwise for anywhere between $3,000 and $8,000 a day, you're wasting my time. You know, and you know, just don't come unprepared. And also don't assume that I'm going to have everything. A good tower crew is going to bring a lot of different things that will solve a lot of different problems with them. You should have the stuff, but if you don't, they should have it too. Things like hose clamps, extra bolts for flanges, you know, things that they might find, like if they might get up there and find a frozen bolt on a flange and have to cut it off, they should have an extra bolt in their bag. It shouldn't be something, well, like, you didn't give me this bolt. you know, these are the things that really rub somebody raw when they're going to tell you they have to climb back up there because there were broken hose clamps on your antenna. And that speaks to another thing. You know, there are certain kinds of antennas that have known failure points, and I'm not calling out manufacturers, but like where, you know, hose clamps are holding the antenna on, and you know, man, I really need to replace these hose clamps like every 3 years, because if I don't, I'm going to have a bay fall off my antenna. I have worked in markets where we had that happen. Had it happen more than once, not on my station, but on other stations in that market, to the point where there's a couple of antennas like that in my stable right now in another market. And I told the guy, put two hose clamps at every location. Hose clamps are cheap. You know, I just told him, I said, the manufacturer put one, you put two. You know, it's just one of these things where I'm not going to be that guy that has to call the vice president of engineering and tell him we lost two bays off the antenna over $3 worth of hose clamps. You know, it's one of those things. It's just start becoming a thinking engineer and start realizing ways that you can give yourself an edge for little or no money. You know, that's when you start going to the next level of doing what's in the manual versus learning the tips and tricks that give yourself an edge. That's when you start going to being a senior engineer versus just being a guy that reads the book.
I like that philosophy. Hose clamps are cheap. You're right. I've rarely had them break. Do you feel that there in Lafayette, are you in a bit of a marine environment? Are you close enough to the Gulf, or what do you think about that?
I can be in the Vermilion Bay in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And the Vermilion Bay is right on the other side of Abbeville. I've got a station that's 5 minutes from Abbeville, so it's on 6-foot pylons. Like the build, you had to climb up a set of stairs to get in the building. It's where I'm 10 or 15 miles from the water. It doesn't seem like that, but we're pretty close. I mean, a storm will be on us pretty quick. And Lake Charles is right on the water. I mean,
tell me about
Calcasieu Lakes. You can see it from our windows. So
tell me your philosophy on grounding at tower sites. What do you want to make sure a tower crew does? The minimum, or how much more than the minimum? Either grounding the tower, grounding coaxes. What's your practice?
Well, as far as what a tower crew is responsible for, I want them to go, and I've got one right here. I brought it with me. I don't ever want the tower crew to go up the tower when they don't take one of these grounding kits with the whole grounding kit. And again, these are cheap. You should have one at your transmitter site. This happens to be for 7/8 line, but they make them for 1 5/8, 3 inch, whatever you have. Should you expect those to be damaged? No, but stuff happens. And so I think that's something they should always have in their bag. Normally you have two climbers that are going up because you need a rescue climber. So it's not like one guy has to carry everything. But that's one of the things I think that they should always take up, because you'll get up there to where the lightning protection is. You should have one of those grounding kits every 200 feet coming down, minimum.
Okay.
And on your STL lines, on your transmission line for your antenna, on any kind of line, because every time you put one of those ground kits, it functions as a voltage divider and gives you a chance to drop that voltage and bleed it off to the tower, which is hopefully a better connection to ground. Obviously can dissipate more current without melting than your transmission line. I mean, that transmission line's copper. It's a great conductor, but it's not very thick. So it can't dissipate a lot of heat without melting a hole in it, which is what's what we're trying to avoid. So the more chances you can give to bleed off some of that that electrical current into the tower leg, the better off you're going to be. Now, what happens when you get to the bottom? This is not really the tower crew's problem, but you need a single point master ground at the site, and you need that tower needs to be grounded into that single point master ground, and then you need to run a dissipation leg from that single point master ground out into the field and put a high frequency ground out in the field so you can bleed up, because lightning has a high frequency component. It has a DC component, but it also has a high frequency component. So you want to run a leg in the opposite direction from your building and put a high frequency ground out in the field away from the tower to where you can dissipate that high frequency component that goes as high as 10 megahertz. Most of it is below that. Most of it's in that 1 megahertz range, but some of it gets higher than that. So you want to be able to dissipate all of that energy that you can in the other direction. And then anything that's coming into your building, you want to continue to add ground kits at regular intervals. You want to ground your ice bridge. You want to ground the legs of your ice bridge. Anything that you can, you want to reduce touch potentials. Touch potential is key because you don't want a man to be leaning up against the ice bridge and have a discharge against the top of the tower, and this person's foot is on the ground and their hand is touching the ice bridge and electrical discharge comes through their body and they're dead. So you can actually, I have test equipment where you can measure touch potential from this object to ground, this object to ground. Those are things you need to consider. And a lot of people don't realize that just because you put a ground rod, it's not going to dissipate that lightning strike. There's going to be an electrical potential that crosses out onto the ground. So when you're standing there, you're going to have a potential difference between your feet. And that's a step potential is what it's called. So you're literally, you need to consider the step potential. You need to consider the touch potential around the site. And you need to look at, you can calculate all those numbers and figure out the safety factor. And then there's things you can do, like place aggregate over the site and do other things to give yourself an edge if somebody were standing there during a fault condition. They do these things in substations, and you can do these things at transmitter sites. You can place 2 or 3 inches of rock over the ground and give yourself an edge so that if there's a dissipation into the ground system from a line surge, or from a lightning strike, because it's not always a lightning strike. Sometimes it's a power line surge that still dumps into your ground system, but you need to be able to dissipate it. Oftentimes, I find broadcasters will tell people their station got struck by lightning, and it was really a surge that came down the power line. And if they would have had a transient voltage suppression system, they might have not taken any damage, because one of the first things I did when I got here is we put a whole building transient voltage surge suppression system on every facility. And it was funny how I could sleep at night after that. But the thing was, they used to take a whole bunch of lightning strikes.
Right.
But it turned out those weren't lightning strikes. It turned out it was the utility company blowing up our facilities all the time. But you put a bunch of these like LEA or transector surge suppressors on the outside of the building that's tied into the ground system and everything's properly, and you clean it up and make it a single point ground, and then all of a sudden the power line is not blowing up your equipment anymore. And then, yes, you can still have lightning strikes and you can do stuff to remediate that, but lightning strikes are so much less common than bad power. Bad power is common everywhere across the country for a lot of different reasons.
What are your thoughts on these dissipation? What are your thoughts on these dissipation devices that go on a tower, typically on the top, but maybe on a tall tower on the sides as well at various intervals?
I think there's worthwhile doing. Some are more effective than others, but I can tell you this: the university where I went to school, they had a doctoral student that did a dissertation on those devices, and it's published online at their website. And he tested everything on the marketplace, from these ones that look like a ball full of sharp spines to the old Franklin lightning rod. And he found that the old straight up lightning rod was as effective or more effective than any of the fancy specialized lightning devices that are out there. We have towers where we use the ERI device, A3 lightning spurs. We have devices where we just have a lightning rod. I actually have one tower where we have a 20-foot lightning rod and three sets of A3 spurs. It's okay. a 1,200 foot tower.
Wow. But
it just kept getting struck. But we did that and put in an extensive grounding field. I think it was about 60 rods. So,
oh my goodness.
But after we put in the extensive grounding system and put up a massive lightning rod, we basically, we've been left alone.
Yeah.
We've been left alone for 5 or 6 years.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean, this is a tower. We put up a brand new 10 bay rototiller antenna. And in the first year we had 2 bays melted off of it. So,
okay. All right.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, we immediately had to assess and plan and design some remediation because, it was just one of these things. A tower's been here for 40 years and the ground system has degraded. And a lot of times people are like, well, we had that, fixed. We had it, you know, it had a ground system. Well, ground systems are just like anything else. They're like your knees. They don't last forever. They degrade. You know what I'm saying? It's like
they get old.
Yeah. So at some point, I mean, if you have an AM station and it's sounding bad, we had an AM station, not one that I worked with, and they were like, oh, you know, people can't pick us up like they used to. I said, have you ever had anybody come out and inspect your grounding system to see? Because if you have acidic soil or other issues, you might not have a grounding system left.
The copper thieves may have come out and inspected the system really well.
And I said, it's not something I have time to do, but you may consider hiring a consultant to come evaluate that and plow in a new ground system if he finds that it's lacking. And you'll be surprised in the difference it'll make. So this was a 60-year-old station. It's probably time to plow in some new copper.
We're talking to Matt Golston. Matt is the director of engineering for Town Square Media in Lafayette, Louisiana, and he's got a wealth of great ideas. A lot of it's common sense. A lot of it is a little bit beyond common sense. I'm Kirk Harnack. It's This Week in Radio Tech, our 559th episode. Now, hang on, because Matt has some amazing things to show us before we round out the show in just a few minutes. So hang with us. I promise you it'll be worth your while. You'll prepare to be amazed, okay? This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by these things. Yes, that is a studio hub adapter. This goes to the back of your standard broadcast equipment, male or female XLRs or quarter-inch tip ring sleeves, even RCA connectors. And this side goes to a piece of Cat 5 cable with an RJ45. Gold-plated connectors right in there. These work great even in high RF fields. They're really well done. And this can be any length of Cat 5 cable and plug that into the back of your AOIP equipment. There are patch bays made for these too, but either, a Wheatstone blade, Axia node, anything that's got that RJ45 that follows the Studio Hub standard, you plug it right in there and you've made a terrific audio connection. This would be for balanced analog. They also have ones that are made for AES EBU. If you like the male XLR already built onto it, here's a short one, female XLR's male RJ45, and you can get them long. This one's about a 6 foot long cable right here from Studio Hub. If you haven't used Studio Hub yet to build a studio, you're really missing out. They make this building the studio quick, easy, no soldering, and very, very reliable. As Matt was talking about earlier, the noise floor way down because they're so well shielded. And here's a device you might be interested in. This would connect to the back of your equipment, either male or female. This would be typically either for a mono balanced or for an AES EBU signal. It's just one simple adapter right there to get it into AES EBU over to your node. And then into the back of your equipment, male or female, for sending or receiving. Also, from Angry Audio, you check it out at angryaudio.com. They have the Studio Hub products. This one, for example, is the headphone amplifier from Studio Hub. It comes in the Decora size there, so you can put that into a electrical box. Put a Decora panel over the front of it to make it look great. And it's got both kinds of connectors, country and Western, as they say, 3.5 millimeter or quarter inch tip ring sleeve. This is a headphone amp, and it can be powered using the Studio Hub power system, and it can be daisy chained as well. I think you can daisy chain up to four of these together on the same power source. It's really, really convenient to hook these up. Check them out at angryaudio.com. Angryaudio.com. You can buy Angry Audio products, the whole Studio Hub line, and other Angry Audio products from your favorite dealer. And if your dealer tries to sell you something else, say, no, I want Angry Audio, or I want Studio Hub. I want the real McCoy. There's a reason why it's better. Hey, This Week in Radio Tech is also brought to you by Max Connect Wireless. Here's a quick announcement about it. We'll be right back.
I'm Gary Morrow, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
I did check it out. Here it is. This is a Max Connect. This one is from PepWave. The one that Gary Morrill showed you was from Cradlepoint. But it doesn't really matter, the 4G LTE modem. That's not what's important. What's important is the SIM cards that are inside it, because they connect to the Max Connect wireless network, which gives you prioritized data and a fixed IP address on the networks of any of the major carriers like AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint. And available in Canada as well. So Max Connect Wireless, you get prioritized data and a fixed IP address for your broadcast-oriented packet needs. Check it out, maxconnectwireless.com. We'll have a link for you in the show notes because it is spelled funny, as you can see on the screen. All right, we've just got a few minutes left. We got to make it quick. Our guest, Matt Golston, has a couple of amazing products. I had no idea these things existed. Matt, take it away and amaze us, please.
Well, certainly I don't represent these products, but they're really cool. I actually got these ideas from my tower crew, who are wonderful people. Mm-hmm. If you have a tower that's a little older and is experiencing some rusting issues where the galvanizing is flaking off, or you've got rusting conduits or anything like that, a product that I recommend that you look into, they make this in a liquid and a gel, but you can use this on the tower, is called Evaporust. And it comes, this is not a very big bottle. You can see it's smaller than my hand, but it's $10. And you just paint it on with a little brush. It's a white gel, and let it sit for an hour or two while they're doing other stuff on the tower, and then rinse it off with a bottle of water. And it will eat the rust off and prep the surface. Now you have to take a wire brush and get rid of any loose scale, but it will prep the surface to accept this other product I'm going to show you. This is legit. This is the galvanizing compound you want to use to repair your galvanize. If you have to scrape some off your tower, or if you have some that has been scraped off your tower, or lightning struck your tower and burnt some galvanize, this is 95% zinc paint, and this quart weighs 20 pounds. So I'm holding this up, but I'm struggling to hold it. Yep, you can see they've clamped the lid on with steel clamps. So, and it's not cheap. This was like $60 or $70 for this quart, but this stuff will, two coats of this will put a 3 mil thickness coat of zinc galvanized back on your tower and keep it from rusting. Especially if it's not a solid leg tower, you really want to keep it from rusting. If you've got tower bolts that are exposed at the bottom, you really want to keep those from rusting, because how are you going to replace them if your tower bolts that go into the ground, your J bolts, rust through? That could be a tragic problem. So this stuff, it's 95% pure zinc, and you do have to stir it like crazy because it'll settle to the bottom. But like I said, this is crazy heavy. I think a gallon of it weighs 30 or 40 pounds. So this is not your Colgal spray. This is really good stuff. So, but yeah, this is the only thing I think that Crown Castle and American Tower will let you paint on their towers. So this is what you want to use. Those are two products I thought I would expose to people. I think you did want me to show you a couple other things. That these are the things that I brought that I was talking about that I think people should send up with tower climbers. If you don't know what these are a butterfly. This is what I was talking about. These are what hold your transmission line on the tower. These are for, I think, 3-inch transmission line. I would always send, maybe not a whole package of these, but at least 3 or 4. It's very common to find these broken, especially in a high wind event if you've had a big storm. And these are cheap. A pack of these is not much money. Just keep a whole pack of these at the transmitter site. Again, these are what bolt your, these are the hangers that often bolt your transmission lines to the tower. Angle adapters, if you have an angle iron tower.
Yeah.
Keep a package of these at the transmitter site. Send a couple of angle adapters. You don't have to send a whole bag. Send 2. If they find an angle adapter missing, oftentimes it's not a storm that got them. Maybe somebody, as if it's a shared tower, maybe a cell company went up there. They're notorious for just taking stuff off that was in their way, and they don't care if it belonged to some broadcaster. They just move it so they can put their new cell phone antenna up, and then now your line's flapping in the breeze. Again, another thing that I keep at every transmitter site is a new hoisting grip. Do I send this up every time? No, but I can't tell you after hurricanes how many times I found a broken hoisting grip.
Yeah.
And again, this is not an expensive item, but this is what holds your transmission line to the tower. And you want this in place. And if you find a broken hoisting grip, this is something that the next time the tower crew goes up, you want them to change it. So you want it to be at the site so you don't have to get it shipped in. So these are just things that I think every transmitter site should have. Like I said before, a grounding kit. I keep a couple of grounding kits. All of this put together under a couple $100. Easy. Maybe less. I haven't priced it all, but you're not talking about just a ton of money. And if you have a whole bunch of transmitter sites and they use all the same size lines at all the transmitter sites, then just have all that stuff in one location at your office and you can share it amongst all those sites. If you have 3-inch line at every site and 7/8-inch line at every site for your STLs, then you don't have to have it for every site. I just keep it here at the office. But just know when you go to do a tower job, toss all that in the toolbox in the truck. But I mean, those are the things. That's the being prepared engineer. That's anticipating the needs of the people that you're hiring. So when you're paying them $3,500 to go up and do this job or $5,000 to do this job, that you're not paying them to come back 2 weeks later. You own a couple of little radio stations. You know how much it costs, and you can't afford to have them come back. And these days with the repack, it's so hard to get them. When is next time?
Yeah.
I mean, next time could be 3 months from now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if I'm lucky to get a tower crew, you know, I want to get everything done because I don't want to wait 90 days for them to come back. So, you know,
Especially if you've got broken butterfly clamps, you'll get coaxes flapping in the breeze up there, and that can be wicked that you won't want to notice from the ground. You, with binoculars, maybe so. With some video from a tower climber, you can really see how damaging that can be if you've got broken butterfly clamps. And the hoisting grip, you're right. That's what really holds the weight of the coax. On a long coax, you might have several of those along the way holding the weight as you go. So, yeah.
And I'll tell you something else.
Critical.
We replaced a couple of dehydrators, and it's been a few years ago. There is a brand of dehydrator out there, and they changed their name recently. It was Pure Gas, and they changed their name to something Air. I can't remember what the new name of the company is. They have SNMP monitoring in the dehydrator.
Oh,
that's a huge feature, because now all of a sudden you can have your SNMP monitoring, like SolarWinds or Orion, or something like that, or your Burke, if your remote control supports SNMP, it can be constantly monitoring your airline pressure, and you can get an email and say, oh, you got a leak, you know, and that's huge because that can alert you to the fact that maybe you had some broken butterflies and it flapped your line around and now you got an O-ring leaking. So, and again, another thing that should be at your transmitter site, extra O-rings, extra dielectric grease, extra bullets for the line because you get a burnt bullet. So many things, extra electrical tape and the mastic tape, all these different things. Start to make a log of things you didn't have and make sure you never don't have them again.
That's, you know, that's Matt, one thing I did was if I needed to buy a bullet or a grounding kit, I'd always buy at least two. Because if I need one now, I'm probably going to need one later. So go ahead and buy two, get that in the budget, you know, get it bought. Things like the things you point out are not that expensive. And that way you can get them, you can have a spare as well as the one you need. Matt, we're out of time. We got to go. I dearly appreciate all the things you've been telling us. Thank you so much for being with us. Matt Golston from Lafayette, Louisiana, from Town Square Media. Thanks for being with us, Matt.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
So, I hope to spend time with you again. Maybe we can pick one topic next time and focus on one thing, but you've provided a wealth of knowledge and information. Yes, sir. Last word?
I would say this on that topic we were just talking about. Develop a good relationship with a couple good salespeople. I know salespeople always want to sell you stuff, but I've got a couple people I buy stuff from, and I'll be placing an order, and they'll say, "Didn't you want an elbow? Didn't you want some bullets for this?" Because these are people that used to be engineers. They will see what you're ordering, and they will see something that in your haste you left out. So start to do things with people that you know had experience in the field that happen to now be salespeople, and they will anticipate your mistakes, and they will save face for you.
Our producer is going to cut us off. I got to go. Thank you again for being here. Yep. Suncast, thank you for producing the show, and also a big thanks to all the sponsors. Be sure you patronize them. Check out our website, thisweekinradiotech.com. Thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. So take care. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.